Happy New Year, everyone, and welcome to a New Year's Day edition of John Solomon Reports, a podcast from Just the News, where today we're going back to an interview I did this past summer with a famous epidemiologist from Stanford University. His name is Jay Bhattacharya, and he, better than anyone, I think, nailed it on the head, the course of where this COVID virus would go, and he began to raise the concerns that ultimately gave rise to the Great Barrington Declaration, that the public health response to COVID was actually more injurious than the virus itself, shutting down, isolating people. He really warned of that. And I thought, heading into the new year, as we evaluate what's going to happen over the next 6 months as we get the vaccine out there, going back and listening to Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, well, it's going to be worth your while. So sit back and enjoy this, and we'll be back Monday with a regular edition of John Solomon Reports. But here's my last favorite from 2020. Folks, Field of Greens is the healthiest thing I do every day, and I want you on this journey with me. Why? It's literally one scoop a day. It tastes great. I love the fruit flavors particularly, and it's completely improved my life and my health. This is nutrition the way nature intended. When I began taking a hard look at why I wasn't feeling good and why I felt unhealthy, why I was gaining weight, why I was losing energy, it wasn't just because I had hit my 50s. No, it was because I wasn't getting the right amount of fruit and vegetables in my diet. And listen, I'm just too busy to go to the store, clean up the vegetables, cook vegetable dinners, and make sure I hit the fruit. A Field of Greens stepped in. One scoop of powder in my drink or on my eggs in the morning, and boom, I was off and feeling better. And suddenly, I was losing weight. I was sleeping better. My metabolism went up. My blood sugar went down. My cholesterol went down, and my weight went down. And my doctor said, hey, whatever you're doing, keep it doing. You know what that is? It's Field of Greens. That's what I've been doing. Field of Greens is radically different. Each organic fruit and vegetable was medically chosen to support heart and vital organ health. I trust Field of Greens to keep me healthy. I promise you, you're going to love this product. But if for any reason you don't, they'll give you 100% money back guarantee. Now, you're going to get 15% off your first order, plus free rush shipping because of the incredible partnership we have here at Just the News with Brickhouse Nutrition and, of course, Field of Greens. All you got to do to take advantage of this offer, visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code JustNews. That's promo code JustNews at fieldofgreens.com. Don't wait. Go to fieldofgreens.com today. Use the promo code JustNews for 15% off. All right, folks, welcome back from the commercial break. And as promised, a very special guest, Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, a professor of medicine and a senior fellow at the Stanford Institute for Economic Policy, joins us. Dr. Bhattacharya, thank you for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Now, you have an interesting academic discipline because you look at medicine and the importance of medicine and health, and you're a medical doctor, but you also look at some of the economic consequences of medical decision-making and medical policy, health policy. Tell us how, as you've been watching this pandemic unfold, those two disciplines are sort of at tension with each other right now.
Well, I mean, the pandemic, it's all of the attention of the world has been focused on the damage and harm from the disease, from COVID-19. And all of the policy making has focused on that as well. But however, the main problem I see from my point of view is that we have forgotten the cost that the mitigation measures we've taken impose on other sides. The game of life isn't simply to avoid getting COVID-19. There are many other ways to be healthy that inputs into healthiness, and we've forgotten all about those. Economics is about trade-offs. We've forgotten the trade-offs. We've forgotten the costs of lockdowns. We've forgotten a whole host of difficult decisions and risks. To me, it's been shocking that it seemed like the most basic thing, which is we should think about both the cost and benefits of policy when we make them. That's been thrown by the wayside.
Really remarkable. And early on in the panic and all the emotion of when we're struck by a pandemic, you would be anathema to even suggest, hey, we should be looking at the economic costs. But as people have seen this play out over several months, and as the public health policy officials have sort of zigzagged through the strategies, the economic cost and the other costs of health, such as mental health, are really starting to become more central to Americans' minds. How did we get this so wrong? When we spend billions of dollars every year preparing for pandemics and other infectious diseases. How are we so ill prepared for the moment that arrived in January?
I mean, I think it's going to be interesting, because I think it's not just a matter of pointing fingers and saying you did this right or wrong. I think it's going to be interesting to answer that, because we need to know it. We need to be ready for the next pandemic. We need to know what sorts of things we
would
need.
Great point.
To me, the key missing thing was information. Early on in the pandemic, we did not have the infrastructure. And I mean we, I don't mean just the United States. I mean the entire world.
The world
did not have
right?
the infrastructure to understand truly how widespread the disease was, or truly how deadly it actually was. This fostered the panic that led to I'd say, terrible health policy decisions all around the world. We need a better infrastructure for gaining that kind of information.
And the finger pointing game is chronic in politics. You know, China this, Trump that, Democrats this. But at the end of the day, this was a global failure, right? The communication systems, the surveillance systems, the understanding of a coronavirus, which, by the way, we had a lot of experience with in the early 2000s. It all seemed to have been disconnected, right? We just weren't connected to each other in a way that made for quick, rational decision-making. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. This is a global issue, and country after country made the same decision, with a couple of exceptions. And I think that was a major problem. In fact, if you look at the pandemic planning books that had come out of the H1N1 epidemic
right.
and others, we didn't follow the plan. The plan partly is to reassure the public, work very hard to assess truly who are at risk and protect them.
Yep.
Instead, what we did is immediately jump to a global lockdown that is, we'll hopefully get to talk about some of the cost of it, because it's not just economic, but lives as well, as you mentioned. But we jumped to that global lockdown where we essentially locked away people who were actually not at high risk from mortality from the disease. And we essentially, in effect, exposed people who were at high risk in nursing homes, in assisted care facilities, elderly populations. We essentially, in effect, in the early days of the epidemic, did the inverse of the right policy. We quarantined the healthy and we exposed the sick, the vulnerable.
That's really well put, and it's almost hard to imagine, but when you look back with 2020 hindsight, that's exactly what we did. When you talked about some of the bad medical decisions that we made, can we go through some of those piece by piece? I think some people forget all the momentous decisions. Let's start with nursing homes, because you pointed out that we sent the sick to the nursing homes, basically creating a more infirmed population, correct?
Yeah. I mean, that was a disastrous decision. And it's something we should have known better at the time. If we can take your listeners back, the reason for that decision, it was simple. There was this mantra of, we have to flatten the curve so that we don't overwhelm hospital systems. We were looking at places like Italy and China, where hospital systems had been overrun.
Right.
And we said, okay, we better do everything we can to avoid that. So we sent people who were had the disease and who were getting better in the hospital, older people, back to nursing homes where they were still infectious, and there was a whole large number of other vulnerable people that then got the disease as a result, in order to keep the hospitals empty. I mean, that was a disaster. The other knock-on effect is that hospitals around the country stayed empty, many of them becoming on the verge of bankruptcy. That's fine, but like the key thing is that a lot of needed care didn't take place. There was a big mystery in the middle of the epidemic. It's sometime in like June, May or June,
right.
Where people were wondering, why are there so few heart attacks? Why are the people not showing for heart attacks? Did heart attacks decrease during COVID? No, they didn't decrease. What happened was that people died at home with heart attacks because they were too afraid to go to the hospital. I mean, these sorts of stories, I think, are going to start to come in focus as we move forward. Avoiding becoming sick with COVID is not the only aim in life,
yeah.
And treating it like that is was a first order mistake.
The the balancing of public health and the other needs, the economy, the schools, all the things that we, mental health, getting treatment for things other than the pandemic related illness. Are we getting a grip on it now? When, as you look now, are we getting to mitigation strategies where we understand that protecting the vulnerable, you can still have some normal activity with the right, you know, procedures and you know, masks and good sanitary conditions? Are we getting to the right point now, or do you still think we have a lot of hysteria?
I mean, I think it's uneven. In some places, again, let's take it from a worldwide rather than just the U.S. Some places seem to have gotten it right. So schools are a good point. Schools and basically most of the world are open for in-person instruction because we've seen the evidence that children don't die of the disease at very high rates. I mean, very, very low rates, in fact, less than the flu,
right?
Yeah. And that they are less likely to spread the disease than adults, much less likely. The children have very little risk of the disease. There is much greater risk to closing schools, to in-person instruction to kids than to letting them have school in person. And schools around the world have opened on the basis of that. I think in the U.S., many places have opened their schools, but many places have not. On fear and ignorance of what the scientific literature is saying.
And why is that? How in this country, the one of the wealthiest, smartest, most well-resourced countries in America, how could we be so far off from following just the good examples of what was done already across the world safely? Is it politics? Is it paranoia or irrational fear? How did we get to this point that we can't make a decision that the rest of the world has generally made?
I mean, I think part of it is panic. I mean, like it sells in the United States to tell stories about that are not rooted in the scientific literature to induce panic, and the press has done that over and over again in ways that
we are guilty, aren't we?
Shocking.
Yeah.
And I think part of it is also politics. I mean, I think the fact that this monumental election is coming up in November has poisoned the well, if you will, on how to people thinking clearly about the science and what its implications are. I mean, I think there are some hopeful things in this country, right? So I think, for instance, Florida, the reason we had this big case surge in Florida. Florida famously has a large elderly population,
right?
And yet, not a large. The fraction of elderly as a proportion of who died is lower in Florida than it is basically in New York and the Northeast and other places. Florida seems to have learned how to protect its elderly. I think we've sort of, as a country, done better in recent days, last couple of months, in protecting the vulnerable. I mean, that's the right policy. Open up for the people who it's safe to open up for, safe in the sense of balance of cost, risk, and benefits, right?
So basically, like the flu, how we mitigate the flu.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we don't shut our world down to get rid of the flu. We take reasonable measures to the extent we have them that are scientifically justified, and we consider the cost and benefits of those measures. You know, we don't force people who have allergies to, negative reactions to vaccine to take the flu shot.
Right.
In general, we say people should take the flu shot because it's a good idea. It's relatively inexpensive and it protects people from the flu, the harm from the flu. We encourage people to wash their hands, stay home if they don't have the flu. I mean, those kinds of measures are completely reasonable here as well. Even social distancing may be reasonable here. You know, there are all kinds of mitigation we can take without shutting the world down. At the same time, that like shutting every business down, closing schools from in-person instruction, it has knock-on effects worldwide that are will have knock-on effects for a very long time that I think we'll live to regret.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, the more that this sinks in, the more that we look at the devastation we've left behind by this sort of zigzagging of public health policy, I think the more people are coming to that conclusion. And in fact, we just had a poll at Just the News yesterday. And the number of people who identified health from the pandemic as the number one concern in June, it had dropped. And now the economic consequences of it are 2-1 a bigger concern for Americans today than they were back in June. And I think people are looking back now, realizing that we probably made a lot of bad decisions. You had a remarkable op-ed in the Wall Street Journal a couple of days ago, and I've read it a couple times because I find it so fascinating. And I think it gets into the zigzagging of the public health policy that we have. You talked a little bit about the CDC maybe getting it right in August and then reversing itself unnecessarily on the question of testing. Could you describe a little bit? The headline is a fantastic headline. The case against COVID tests for the young and healthy. You're arguing that empirically through data that it isn't necessary to test people who are healthy or young, that we should be focusing on the vulnerable. Describe what you wrote there and what the reaction's been to it.
Sure. This is one place where the CDC reversed itself and got it right. The current CDC policy is don't test the asymptomatic, people who have no symptoms at all, look searching for the disease. And the argument is that let me give you the argument, the scientific evidence, and I'll tell you about the policy implications. The scientific evidence is that the asymptomatic spread the disease at much lower rates. Especially kids spread the disease to adults at much lower rates than people who have symptoms. The disease spreads by essentially like coughing, sneezing, droplets. To some extent, there's some evidence of aerosolization, but those are like much rarer than the droplets. So if you have a cold, if you have cold-like symptoms, or you have symptoms that look like COVID, for the most part, you can stay at home and not spread it. Now you should, of course, at home, you have to be careful. But now, what are the costs of testing indiscriminately? Well, the costs are this. When we see a rise in the number of cases, it's almost inevitable there's this impulse to quarantine, to close down. And in the case of schools, shutting the schools down, if you find a few cases, asymptomatic cases, is catastrophically costly to me. As we were talking about earlier, in-person schooling is vital. I mean, how do you teach a first grader how to read on Zoom?
Yeah, not going to happen.
I mean, it doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't.
The cost of closing the schools down is enormous, whereas the benefit, which is, okay, we've stopped the spread of the disease by asymptomatic people, that benefit is tiny by comparison, because the kids don't spread the disease to the adults at very high rates. They don't die from the disease. It's more kids have died of the flu this year than COVID-19.
Yeah, that's irrefutable.
So I think the main cost to me is panic, inducing panic when you do these tests. Let me give you one other reason, scientific reason, why the testing I think is problematic for asymptomatics. It turns out that we think about this test to see if you have the virus as if it were a perfectly accurate test. It turns out that's not true. There's a lot of evidence emerging that there are false positives from this test. Even after, so let's say I get the infection, and then I get worse and I get better, right? So 10 days later, I'm basically through with it. It was a really, really bad cold for me. I mean, I didn't end up in the hospital or anything.
Uh-huh.
It turns out that people like that still have a little bit of virus left in them, but it's not infectious. Like your immune system has crushed most of it. It's just a little viral fragment that can't hurt anybody, not even the person infected. The test will pick up those viral fragments as positive, which means that there are false positives. People who've recovered from the thing are asymptomatic. Many of them are utterly non-infectious. They're false positives functionally, and they pose no risk to themselves or anyone else. And yet, we'll identify them as a case and shut down schools using this sort of idea that all we have to do is like prevent cases and we'll be healthy.
Right.
I think the key thing to remember is that no medical test is perfect, and nor is this one. And so we need to think about the cost and benefits carefully. Here, the benefits, just not closing schools down, letting people go on with their lives, learn, is vastly outweigh the cost. Especially if schools take reasonable mitigation measures, right? So you ask kids to the extent that it's possible to socially distance from the adults that are teaching. You have cleaning measures of the schools. You should take reasonable cautions. This is a deadly disease, but it's not so deadly that we have to ignore all the benefits of living life like the schooling, the work, all these other things that are important in life.
The institutions that were set up to deal with this very moment, the NIH and particularly NIAID, WHO, the World Health Organization, CDC, how do you grade their performance as the master policy setters for this this pandemic?
I'd say mixed at best. I think the World Health Organization very early on released a mortality estimate that was sharply out of line with reality. You know, they said that 3.4% of people who get the disease essentially would die. That's what they implied,
right,
by their estimate. And they ignored that there were many people that get the disease that weren't measuring.
Right.
And that induced a worldwide panic. The institutions were guided by models that were not based in actual data. They were based in assumptions of worst cases. And all of our institutions, including institutions like the NIH and the CDC, but this is just, I mean, I don't blame them in particular. It was a worldwide phenomenon.
Right.
Reacted to that lack of information by essentially pushing the worst case scenario, saying if we don't shut down, we're going to have millions and millions of people in the United States dead.
Right.
If it were true and it were based on actual data, you know, real solid information, that millions would die if we didn't shut down, then I would be the first one leading the charge to shut down.
That's right.
I mean, it's unacceptable to have millions of people, Americans die, or millions of people around the world die from something that's preventable. That's not where we were. Where we were was a situation where the data was really, really poor. We had models that were telling us that in worst cases, bad things can happen. In best cases, it's not so bad. And we jumped to the worst case, ignoring the cost of the mitigation measures we put in place, these lockdowns, to avoid a worst case that was never going to come.
Right. Yeah, no, that seems to be the lessons that people, even the most strident alarmist, you know, or the strident warners a few months ago now are beginning to see, I think, and acknowledge that there were that we executed along a worst case scenario when in fact the data was at best, you know, misleading or incomplete. One of the things I want to ask about, because it seems like we're always looking for a magic bullet, new drug every time we get a new disease. And that's, you know, one of the great things about America. We have one of the greatest pharmacological and biological research capabilities in the world. But did we miss an opportunity to find more over the table or more commonplace treatments that could help us short term while we're developing a vaccine or developing a new anti-coronavirus drug? I saw the other day, you know, steroids appear to be helping people. There's the debate over hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin. There's a debate over using pneumonia drugs since a lot of people develop pneumonia-like symptoms. When you look back, were we trying to find a magic bullet when there were some tools in our toolbox that we could have used sooner and earlier?
I mean, that steroid story is actually a success story there.
It is.
I think one of the reasons why the death rate from the disease has declined so sharply is in the most severe cases is that we are using steroids very effectively to make sure that the disease doesn't overwhelm your immune
body,
system.
Right.
Early on, I think also we made some mistakes in ventilator use. We were over aggressive with the ventilators that we've learned from. So in some sense, like it is a good story, right? So some cheap things that we've discovered that have really made a big difference in survival from the disease if you get the bad form of it. At the same time, you are absolutely right. There are huge incentives to focus on expensive new patented drugs. So early on there was this drug remdesivir, which
right.
is, it's not bad, but it's not, I mean, I wouldn't call it silver bullet,
right?
But it's expensive and on patent. So we tend to overlook the cheaper things that might work. The fight over hydroxychloroquine has been absolutely extraordinary to me. I mean, this is a drug that's been used for, you know, a century.
Yeah.
Where
you go to Africa, you're going to take it because of malaria, right?
It's still used commonly in the United States to treat rheumatoid arthritis.
Right.
There's a big literature on how on the safety of it. And, you know, every drug has side effects, but this drug is relatively safe. I personally have taken it when I was in medical school, when I went to work in a foreign country where there was malaria risk.
Right.
I mean, it's a relatively safe drug, and yet the fight over it has been enormous in a way that I just can't, I can't fathom. I mean, partly it's obvious, it seems like it's so clearly political because President Trump said something about it, therefore it must be false.
Right.
I mean, so that kind of idea, that kind of attitude has been, I mean, I'd been shocked by the scientific literature's reaction to political. I mean, like, science should be divorced from that, right? So who cares what's happening in the political world? If one politician says this drug is good and another says it's bad, we should be completely agnostic to that
That's
and
right.
focus on the
The
data.
data, right?
And
Yeah.
yet it's taboo to say anything about hydroxychloroquine now. I mean, there's the scientific debate over it has been tainted by the politics in a way that makes it difficult to know what's right and what's wrong.
Yeah. And you see Harvey Risch and other people now that have just tried to push back against the politics, saying, listen, forget the politics for a second. Let's look at this early intervention where there is some data suggesting that the triple therapy works. And that can't break through. It's impossible to break through in
Yeah,
this
it's
environment.
stunning, right? I mean, I think one of these things where, like, Harvey Risch is, I mean, he's been working on this drug for a very long time.
Yeah.
He's an amazing epidemiologist,
He is
and
very
yet,
well respected.
it's because his opinion sort of enters the political arena. Therefore, he's wrong on the epidemiology. It's just, I mean, it's amazing to me,
Yeah.
but not in a good way.
No, we need to all take a deep breath from this moment, and hopefully we learn, because these pandemics are going to keep coming because the population in the world keeps growing, and the animal to human cycle continues to grow. Was there an opportunity? This is something I've always meant to ask the experts I've had on this show. We knew SARS and MERS were coronaviruses that had made the leap. Did we miss an opportunity to go back? Those were isolated. We were able to keep those controlled. Did we miss an opportunity in the late 2000s, maybe to start to create a base vaccine or develop a regimen in case a coronavirus did get widespread like this one?
I mean, I think one of the reasons why we've seen such progress, such rapid progress on vaccines, is our experience with those viruses. I mean, we did learn something from them.
Right.
I mean, I think the science of managing coronaviruses is it's a difficult virus to produce a vaccine for. At least that's what I thought before the epidemic.
Right.
I mean, that's why I mean, I think there were some animal vaccines, but no human vaccines had sort of worked out. So I think we had learned some things from that those lessons have clearly carried over. I mean, it was like getting a vaccine this rapidly is a huge scientific achievement in one sense.
It is remarkable.
So I think we did learn something, but we also I think we the things the lessons we kind of learned from that those epidemics we unlearned at the beginning of this one. Because the early estimates of the death rates were so high, and we there was a panic. In H1N1, the swine flu epidemic, that's a good example of an epidemic where the estimates of the initial estimates of mortality were very, very high, and we sort of quickly learned. But there was a vaccine that got developed relatively quickly because it
Right.
was a flu vaccine. It was a flu, and we knew a lot about how to manage the flu with a vaccine. But the death rates came down very sharply as we learned how widespread the disease actually was. That's a lesson that we should have known from earlier epidemics that we didn't learn in this one. We saw the early death numbers and panicked over them.
Yep.
And when I say we, I mean people who should have known better,
Right.
the World Health Organization, the NIH, the NIAID, the CDC. They panicked over them, creating this push for lockdowns. Which had basically never been tried before as a mitigation strategy.
Right.
So I think it's one of these things where like I look back and I can't understand how so many people jumped to this mitigation strategy when there had been a playbook essentially to address the epidemic in ways that took into account both the cost and benefits of the policies.
So the scenario, and I want to see if I can simplify this from my simple mind here, but when you have a limited outbreak of a disease, like what happened with Ebola, then contact tracing and all of those efforts make sense because you're trying to keep it from the population. But once something's in the population as widely as we learned by early February, right, the real thing is to protect the vulnerable and then try to keep the rest of the country, you know, using good practices, but moving along. Is that the difference here? We thought we were dealing with an Ebola when, in fact, we already had a widespread flu-like outbreak.
John, you got it exactly. I wish you had been in charge in those early days.
Oh, you wouldn't want me in charge.
Exactly right. We jumped to this idea that we can, if we just do enough testing, if we just isolate everyone who has it, and we quarantine them, test, trace, contact trace, and isolate, that works for diseases that are not that infectious, that last a long time if you get them, and if you isolate them, you can basically identify everyone who has it, contain the spread.
Right.
That was not the situation we were in. Even I think by early March, it was too late in the United States for that. I think that paradigm, this test, trace, and isolate paradigm, it actually kind of persists today. It's that paradigm misapplied here is the root of a lot of the harm.
Yeah. That's what I think people are coming to realize now. And I think that's why you're starting to see some fresh perspectives break into the public policy realm. The change by the CDC in August was, I think, a sign that we're going to re-engineer the way we did this. Are we living with coronavirus for a long time to come? Is this going to be like the flu now? We're going to have to learn to live with it and get vaccines? Or is this a one or two seasonal occasion?
You know, SARS and MERS disappeared, and we don't really know why.
Yeah.
So it could be like that. It was obviously worse than SARS and MERS.
Right.
It could be that it just disappears, for reasons that we're going to debate over for a long time. So in Sweden, for instance, the number of cases is near zero.
Yeah. In New York, it's really low too now after the big outbreak.
There's a big debate going on: is it herd immunity? Is it something else? We don't understand exactly why.
Right.
It could just be like that. But then there are other folks who say, okay, it's going to come back with a second wave. I suppose time will tell.
Right.
I think even if it disappears, we are going to be living with it forever.
Yeah.
Because I think the consequences of the lockdown are going to reverberate for a very long time. And I think, I hope that we look back and redesign our health policy toolkit to deal with similar situations so that we don't make the same mistakes again.
Yeah, that's got to be the biggest learning of these very painful eight last months for sure. Real quick at the end, I think we've caught some of it, but what are the five biggest myths that we misacted on in the pandemic? One of them has to be that children and asymptomatic spread are a big risk. Clearly that's not, right?
I mean, especially children, the idea that children spread the disease is flatly contradicted by the data.
Right.
They spread the disease at very low rates, and they die at low rates from the disease. For children, children are spreaders of the flu, but they are not. We think about them as you know, I have three kids, and when they were young, I used to get sick all the time
because
infections back from their daycare. That's not the case with this disease. The evidence suggests they don't spread the disease. That's certainly one of the big five myths. The second one I'd say is that it's uniformly deadly. That's false.
Right.
The evidence now suggests that out of 1,000 people that get the disease, somewhere between 997 and 998 will survive.
Wow. So that's 3/10 of a about three times what a flu would be, right?
It's not a death sentence.
Right.
It's not Ebola.
Right.
It's bad. Especially if you're one of the two or three, obviously it's bad.
Yes.
But it's two or three out of 1,000.
Right.
I think the third myth is that lockdowns are an effective strategy to eradicate a disease like this. Test, trace, lockdown are not ways to address, to eradicate. I think people in the back of their heads thought, well, if we just drink our castor oil, shut down our economy for a while, the disease will go away.
Yeah, not happening.
That's false. That was false at the time, and it's false still true today. So I think I'd say that's big myth number three. Related to that, myth number four: more testing is always better. That's not true. depends on what the testing is used for, what that information is, what you do with that. It's testing people who are really, who you believe might have the disease so you can treat them appropriately. That's completely useful. You use tests to save lives, not just to know the number so that you can put it on a scary looking graph
chart,
that induces panic. I think that is a big myth. Like, I think we have to think about testing strategically. Even if we had infinite tests, you shouldn't necessarily test everybody,
right?
All the time. It depends on what the information you use it for. There's so many possibilities for myth five, but I think myth five would be that the cost of the lockdown, the cost of these mitigation policies, are not zero.
Right.
Worldwide, they've proved in many senses disaster. I saw this absolutely heartbreaking report from the UN that over 130 million additional children worldwide will starve, will suffer malnutrition as a result of these lockdowns.
So that's above the normal number of children that starve already, right?
We're going to see a resurgence of polio. We'll see a resurgence of measles worldwide and in the United States.
Mm.
We'll see a resurgence of some of these childhood conditions that we thought we'd licked. So I think myth five is the cost of these lockdowns are not zero. They're disastrous in many places, in many, many ways. And we should account for that in our decision making.
That's got to be one of the learnings going forward. Well, folks, I think you now know why we asked Dr. Jay Bhattacharya to come on the show. What a lesson and what a journey we just had. Doctor, I can't thank you enough for, first of all, the thoughtful things you said today, but also the work you've done up to the op-eds and some of the other things that you've put into the public discourse the last couple of months, I think particularly have been resonating with people as common sense. And we need more of that. We need more folks like you in the public policy realm to help us get through these very difficult times. So thank you for joining us today.
John, thank you for the kind words. Thanks for the opportunity to talk.
It was my pleasure. All right, folks, we're going to come back and wrap things up right after this commercial break. Folks, if you owe back taxes, fair warning, you're not going to like this. The IRS is mailing millions of pay-up letters. Millions, I say. Then it's up to the 20,000 new IRS enforcement agents to find you. Why the IRS targets you and not millionaires? Well, because millionaires have tax lawyers. You don't. You'll pay up. Plus interest and penalties. You need Tax Network USA, and you need them now. Tax Network USA has brilliant war room strategies to solve your IRS problems quickly and in your favor. Like a preferred direct line to the IRS, they know which agents to deal with and who to avoid. It's not all bad news for you because Tax Network USA learned of a special limited time IRS offer. They're willing to waive $1 billion in penalties if you qualify. So schedule your free confidential consultation to see if you qualify for this limited time IRS penalty canceling offer. To do so, call 1-800-245-6000. That's 1-800-245-6000 or visit tnusa.com/justnews. That's tnusa.com/justnews.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
That wraps up another edition of John Solomon Reports, the podcast from Just the News. I'm so grateful you joined me coming out of this weekend. I think we have some very important stories, and I think you now understand why we invited Dr. Jay Bhattacharya to join us. He really has taken the time to look at the consequences of the shutdown, the unnecessary actions, sending the sick to the nursing homes and getting them sicker, keeping kids from school unnecessarily, thinking that we could contact trace this pandemic away when there was no such opportunity to do so, misreading the early data that occurred in this pandemic. These are important points. He's verified them through facts and research, one of the most important and sage voices
in the learning and aftermath of the pandemic we've been through thus far. I hope you enjoyed listening to him. Now, tomorrow we're going to be back. We've got some exclusive stories coming out. We're going to bring some of the reporters that you get to read every day on Just the News on the podcast to talk. We're going to talk a little bit more about this Preet Bharara story. We're going to talk about Russia, going to talk about the pandemic. And if we're lucky, we might even talk about a story about Joe Biden, Hunter Biden, and China. Yes, they're singing a different tune in Biden land today, but it wasn't that long ago when the Bidens thought China was pretty cool to cash in on. We're going to explain that in an exclusive story tomorrow by my colleague, Seamus Bruner. Stay tuned for that. All right, until tomorrow, wishing you well. Thank you for listening to John Solomon Reports and checking out the news at justthenews.com. We'll be back in a day with more news, more interviews, more important insights. At Just the News, we break the stories others in the media ignore or are too afraid to tell. We did it on Russia collusion, Hunter Biden, and the security and intelligence failures that preceded January 6th. Our stories have real impact and reach because we stick to the facts. I'm John Solomon. You can help me expand our honest, unvarnished, and unbiased reporting by becoming a premium member at Just the News. You'll get an ad-free experience and exclusive member-only access to events, and you'll be helping us dig up more truth. Join today at justthenews.com/subscribe.